Right, but just right. Coming to terms with I gotta go, like, yeah. That's and that was the hardest, because like my marriage, I think I'd been tapped out for at least 5 years before mm-hmm. I said, oh, I should leave this, I don't have to stay here, yeah. And actually coming to that decision and then communicating it to the spouse is, I think, it's scary, it's terrifying.
So you were the one that ended it?
Oh yeah, yeah, I did, and he was blindsided by it, and I, looking back, I'm trying to figure out why.
That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, because I'm sure in your mind you felt like he has to see this coming.
I did, especially because we weren't sleeping in the same bed. He was sleeping on the couch.
Yeah.
Like, part of it was because he was sick, he was up coughing a lot, but it just kind of became the normal. He would come to bed, like, at 3, and I would get up early and go to work. I was getting up at 4 just to leave the house so I could go to work in ungodly hours. I didn't have to be at work till 7:30. I'd get there at 6 because I don't want to be at my house. Mm-hmm. I would stay out. I'd work 12 hours, even though there was no need to. I was a high school teacher. And then I would just run errands all weekend. I didn't realize I was trying not to be at home. And he didn't want to go out and do anything with me. Like, friends would invite us out, I'd go, he'd stay, and that became the norm. So it's like, you know, in retrospect, it's like, how did you not think, what made you think things were going well? Like, we right. hadn't had sex in probably 3 or 4 years also.
Yeah, that's what's like, kind of strange. Like, all the signs are pointing to yeah. time to split.
I mean, but it took me a while to put all the pieces together.
What do you think took you so long?
I was terrified. My mom, because my parents got divorced right before, or they were going through their divorce when I got married. And I was like, I'm never getting divorced, because I watched it. I mean, I was a yeah. grown woman watching my parents
yeah.
argue and the backlash that my mom went through. I mean, it was really hard to watch. And so I was like, I never want to go through that. And then, because I was like, oh, you meet that one person and you're with them forever. So I was like, oh, I signed up forever, for better or for worse. I guess I got to stick it out, even though I hate my life. I hated my life.
Yeah.
It wasn't about me. I had no hobbies anymore. I didn't feel supported in trying anything new. It was always all about him and his projects and how I could help him succeed and help him live his best life. And he did none of that for me.
Really?
None of that for me.
So what were some of his projects?
So he was a videographer mm-hmm. and a writer. That's what he wanted to do. And
it's a classic story, isn't
it? Yes. Yeah. I was married to the starving artist that wanted to live and die for their art and just, you know, didn't want to work a normal job because he didn't want to work for the man. Who wants to work for the man?
No one wants to work for the man. I'm not even sure the man wants to be there sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, God damn it, I'm the man. We argued about money constantly because I worked 2 jobs most of our marriage. I've always kind of been a workaholic, so mm-hmm. some of that I think was my escaping. But I think part of it is like, I also was like, God, I gotta make sure we pay rent.
Yeah.
Like, we should get some groceries, like little things like that. And he only worked part time for most of the time mm-hmm. we were together. And you know, having the health problems, like, you know, he had a kidney transplant. You can't just jump back into work after that. And he was ill a lot. So it was hard for him to work 40 hours, but he wasn't willing to even give it a shot a lot mm-hmm. of the times mm-hmm. because he wanted time to write. And he was very talented. He's very talented. I shouldn't speak. He's still alive.
Oh,
I don't know where the hell he is.
The kidney thing.
I don't care.
Yeah.
Actually, I, every once in a while, I'll Instagram, social media stalk him.
I liked Instagram.
Instagram. It's the British.
It's a little bit of class.
I'll stalk him to see what he's up to. I don't know if he's had another transplant, but it looks like he's on.
What's the transplant deal?
Like, kidney transplant?
No, I mean, I know what it is, but why him?
He has chronic kidney disease, so it's based out of an autoimmune disorder. So no matter, he'll just go through kidneys like shoes. Like,
no kidding.
Yeah, there's no cure. So he got a transplant. His transplant from his first one was from his dad, and that's like the best possible match.
Of course, yeah.
Is a living relative. And so that had lasted, I mean, if he still has it, he got the transplant in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they didn't think, I think, when, okay, so I left in 2010, mm-hmm. 11, 9, somewhere in there, 8, I think 10. Yes, 2010. He still had it, but he was already losing function. So his kidney function was declining because his body perceived his kidneys, his own kidneys, and then the transplant kidney as a threat. And so it just attacked it. And it was on like 12 immunosuppressants to prevent that from happening as quickly as it was going to happen. So it's incurable. It's just, yeah.
When are we going to fight back against the kidneys is what I'm wondering.
So
that sounds awful. Like, so how many transplants total did he have?
When I was with him, just one, but he potentially could have had another one by now. I know he went back on dialysis a couple years ago.
What a prospect, you know, having to go through organs multiple times.
Yeah. I mean, and like, in some ways he dealt with it really well, is like, this is part of my life, but it also affected his mental health. And sometimes it's like, he would fear dying at a young age. I mean, he's 10 years older than me, so he's 51 now.
So what constitutes as a young age sometimes?
Yeah, he went into kidney failure at 29, but they retroactively told him that. It wasn't until he was 31 that they're like, oh,
you've been in kidney failure all this time?
Yeah, he was getting his blood pressure shot through the roof. He was a runner, like, he was super active, but his blood pressure, and really thin blood pressure, was insane. And they just said, oh, he's nervous when we take his blood. But they just thought, oh, you're at the doctor, you're nervous.
Yeah, I can see that.
And then after
that,
like 2 years, and he was getting insane headaches, and he was hospitalized multiple times. And it wasn't until he was 31 that they're like, oh, you have kidney disease, and your kidneys you're going into kidney failure. He had like 10% kidney, 10% use of his kidney by the time I met him.
Yeah.
And he was 32 when I met him. So,
Okay. So how long were you guys married?
It's funny. I always say 10 years, but I got together with him in 2000 and I left in 2010. So we got married in 2002. So I was married to him 8 years. I was with him for 10 total.
What kinds of things did you do to, I don't know, give you some comfort during the divorce process? Like, did you watch movies? Did you read books?
Yeah, I do.
You know, people have been through it before.
I talked to my mom a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I learned a lot more about my mom and dad's relationship. I think my mom, it's not necessarily like I was asking, like, tell me how yours fell apart. But I think it also helped my mom in some ways process, because it was something we could both relate to. My family was really supportive. I remember my mom and sisters, and even my dad. It's funny because my parents had been divorced for 10 years by the time I got divorced, and they are both saying the same thing to me, is like, yeah, we're not surprised. Like, we knew this was not a good fit, but we weren't going to tell you. Like,
isn't that weird?
Yeah. It's like, part of me was like, why didn't somebody tell me and save myself? But I learned a lot about myself through the mistakes I made in my marriage. And then,
do you think you could tell, like, in the beginning? Objectively, do you think you could tell if people are going to work or not?
I think I don't know if you can, but I think what they saw is, my life stopped being my own and I lived for him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, he's in the hospital all the time. Like, I was like his home healthcare nurse. Like, I took care, my job became to take care of him and make his quality of life amazing and fuck whatever I wanted for myself. And I didn't see it that way. I think I thought I was being altruistic. Like, oh, I'm caring for somebody that I love and I want them to have a good quality of life. 'Cause I did, but I didn't realize that in doing so, I lost the balance of being my own person. Like, I no longer was an individual. I was part of this marriage, and apparently the marriage was all about him.
Where do you think you realize that?
I don't think I could concretely, like, see that happen until I was out of the marriage.
Until the divorce, it was, like, done?
Yeah. I knew I wasn't happy, and I remember he kept asking me, but why? And I couldn't articulate it. I just, like, knew in my gut and my being, and I had a different counselor then, but, like, she was like, you have all the, this is, you're saying the right things. Like, if you need to leave, you need to leave. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Made sense to everybody. Like, my family, his family didn't get it. He didn't get it. I had tried to do marriage counseling with him years before, just to help us deal with the health stuff. And he was like, I don't need counseling. I don't believe in it. It's not helpful. But when I left, he's like, we should do marriage counseling. I'm like, okay, I'm not saying it's not going to make me change my mind, because I knew when I left, I was like, yeah, I knew I was done. But I was like, maybe this will help us sort through it better. And in doing that, it was interesting because the counselor that we were going to could see why I left and helped me point it out to him because I never got to talk. I mean, I talk a ton. But when I had a problem with him, what happens is I would try to tell him and he would be like, well, I need an example. And I wouldn't be able to give him a specific day and time the thing happened. And so he's like, well, then it's not a thing. So basically, if I couldn't give him a day, a time, an exact example of something he had done to harm me or hurt me, it didn't exist.
To your husband or to the counselor?
The counselor pointed that out. Because she watched it happen in counseling. Is she asked me to I don't remember. I was trying to explain something to Sean.
Yeah.
And he kept saying, well, give me an example.
Right.
And I was trying to. He's like, no, tell me when this happened.
Yeah.
And I started crying. Like, he kept doing that. And I started crying. And the counselor like, stop. Do you see what you're doing to her right now? And I was able to say, this has been a problem. This has been happening for years.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you need to listen to her. She does not need to give you a day and a time. She can say, you hurt me. This is how. And you need to listen to that and take it. And he was like, at that point, he was like,
Is that what gaslighting is? Is that gaslighting?
I don't know.
Is that a symptom of gaslighting? It's a word that's used a lot.
It is. I'm like, yeah. What does that even mean?
It means essentially, as far as I understand it, like making your significant other believe things or disbelieve things that aren't true. And in fact, like controlling their reality so much that you begin to question events, chronology, things like that.
Yeah.
It's a manipulative tactic. And,
yeah.
And that it sounds like, yeah, because I mean, my brother would do shit like that ever since we were kids in arguments, you know, well, tell me when.
Mm-hmm.
And you inevitably can't say, I don't know. I didn't keep a journal of this stuff. Yeah, see, so it didn't happen.
Yep.
Like, how does that work?
Yeah. Maybe that was what it was happening.
Yeah.
It would come down to, well, then it's not a problem. And so I just thought I was crazy and making things up.
Yeah.
But I knew deep down I wasn't. It's like, well, why do I feel this way? It wasn't irrational. I was like, I would get upset with him because I would ask him to come to bed with me at least a couple nights a week. And he's like, he wouldn't. He's like, mm-hmm. I need a write. I need quiet. If I came home from work, I'd go into the office to talk to him and he would be annoyed that I interrupted him. I'm like, I haven't seen you all day. Like, I want to come and say hi. And he would be like, I'm writing right now. You're going to throw off my focus. I'm like, every single day. So I'd start pulling these things out and he's like, well, why is that a problem? We're like, you know, friends invite us out and I show up and you don't.
Yeah.
How do you think our friends feel about that?
So you never saw me this as a problem.
No, because he wanted to call the shots. He wanted, like, and when I left, I stayed with him at the time, a mutual friend, and I asked him, I said, I need some space. I want to kind of process. Please don't contact me. Just give me a week. And he couldn't do that. He texted me that line. I love you. He, that week, he had the spare key to my car and he would leave things in my car.
Like what? What
would you he left me flowers once in my car. He'd given me a glass heart that was like this big.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, and I'd left that behind because I just basically took my clothes and my pillow. I was sleeping on the floor of a friend's house. It didn't take all my belongings at that time. But he left that in my car. He would drive by the place I was staying to find out, like, if I was there or not. He realized we were still on the same phone plan. He started, I don't know why I happened to look at our phone bill, but every number I called, he called. So he would see online, you know, I was calling, checking for apartments, like that sort of thing. And so he would follow up and call the same number. So it was like, he just became like a stalker.
Right.
And then because he was friends with the people that I was staying with, the person I was staying with, he started asking her what I was doing. Like, so if I left, when I went out, who was I with? Where was I going? So he wouldn't ask me directly, but he would ask everybody around me. So it became an unsafe place for me. Because he also suspected that maybe I was cheating on him, and I absolutely was. And that wasn't why. I think that was one of the contributing factors to me leaving is I had cheated on him twice,
mm-hmm.
and nobody knew. I think I told my mom when I decided to leave him. I told her. I hadn't told anybody mm-hmm. else because I was so ashamed. But it was like I remember I was falling into the same pattern with the person I ended up being with for 6 years. I was like, I knew I was like falling for him and I was spending all my time with him, even though nothing physical was happening, emotionally, absolutely.
So you did physically cheat on him or you didn't?
I did with two other people. Uh-huh. And then the third time when I knew I was had emotions for this other guy, that was like, I was like, Jen, there's a pattern here. Like, you're unhappy.
You're saying it in a million ways. You got to leave.
Yeah. And so that was it. Cause I didn't want, cause he didn't deserve that. Like I realized I wasn't doing it to hurt him. I was looking for love and acceptance that I wasn't getting from him.
Yeah.
And I, of course, in retrospect, I put all that together, but yeah, so it, when it came out, like, that I was spending time with this other guy who was a kind of a distant friend to the person I was staying with, she kicked me out. She's like, you have 24 hours to tell your husband. Like, she was, and I remember just being appalled, like, this isn't any of your business.
Right.
Like, the people that we ran with at that time that we'd been friends with, we all went to college together. We all did everything together all the time. And it was very codependent.
Wow.
Like,
it's like a movie.
It is. Yeah, it was
like St. Elmo's fire.
Right? Yeah. A little bit. But like, I had one friend outside of that group of friends. That was my peer group, period. And everybody knew each other. So you couldn't even, now I know I have friends in different like venues that some know each other, some don't. And I think that's really great. Like, you need to have a variety of people, but we were so codependent and up each other's asses so that when I went through my divorce, everybody decided I was the worst person ever and ostracized me
right away.
Like, but as soon as they found out, everybody is like, they're like, you need to tell everybody. Why the fuck do I need to tell everybody I cheated on my husband? It has nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
And even my husband was like, this has nothing to do with you guys. He was upset that even though he was the one who had been cheated on, he was sticking up to these people because he was like, this has nothing to do with you. It's between me and Jen. And you don't get a say in it. And I remember I talked to another friend, and she, like, who was friends with both him and I, and she's like, well, I don't know how I feel. I guess I need to hear both your guys' side of the story, and then I'll decide what I think. And that's still, even though I don't talk to that person anymore either, I was like, since when did your peers become your judge and jury? Like, you should be able to talk to people and should be open about your missteps. Like, I was by no means saying, yeah, I'm in the right. That was awesome. I should totally do things. Like, everybody should cheat. Like, I felt really, I was facing my own demons.
Everyone should experience that. Yeah, it's wonderful. Like, it's thrilling.
Yeah. It was just like, you should be able to talk openly about your mistakes. And because I think that's what helps people grow from them, you know?
Yeah.
But it's so quick to judge. But at first I was devastated that I lost this entire peer group. It was like 10 people. And then I realized how unhealthy it was and how weird it was that I allowed all of them to decide if I was a good person or bad person. Like, another person in that group said, well, you know, I wish it was hard because they're struggling. Like, we want to be friends with you both, but what do we do? Like, you know, if one of you did something, it's like, oh, that's easy. I'll just hate Sean. Oh, but if Jen messed up, or, you know, then I'll just, that's easy. I'll hate Jen. I'm like, why does it have to be a cut and dried?
Yeah.
Everybody makes mistakes. Ain't none of you saints. Right. Like, why
do you have to like draw lines?
Yeah.
You know?
And then, you know, so it hurt, but then I was like, I don't want to be around people where that's going to be how they treat you after being friends for a decade. And like, no, you made this one mistake. Now we're going to hate you. Like, nobody deserves that.
No.
You know, and I, like, I carried the shame of cheating on my husband for a long time. And now, like,
scarlet letter, eh?
Yeah. Seriously. I really felt like I almost said Hermione. Hester Prynne.
Yeah.
Hermione Prynne. It's a new character.
We should probably update it. It's probably due for a redo. Reimagining.
Mm-hmm. But I became...
With wizards.
Yes, with wizards, absolutely. Makes it more interesting.
Adulterous wizards.
Should be the next
teenage adulterous wizards.
I bet it would be a bestseller.
Well, I own it now.
There we go. Now we have Hold You to It.
Yeah.
That'll be your next great American novel.
It'll be my first great American novel. And with an idea like that, I don't need any more. It'll be the only great American.
No, nope. You'll be able to retire off that. You'll be like
well, more than that. I think it'll go down in literary history.
Well, it should.
Something of a of a master.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
So I'm sorry, please continue. You felt like Hester Prynne.
I did feel like
Hester Prynne. You didn't look like her.
Before, yeah, well, that's good. I mean, unless it could be the Hester Prynne that Demi Moore played.
I'd love to look like that. Her. Yeah, remember when she played her?
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want to look like Demi Moore? Right? Speaking of St. Elmo's Fire.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, and connect it all.
I did. I think
you can't live your life as if you're Demi Moore, Jen.
God damn it, why not?
Did anyone ever tell you that?
No.
During this time, no one ever said that.
No one's ever said that.
See, that's probably where it went wrong. No one said those words.
Till now.
Well, you're a health coach. Now you can give that advice.
Yes.
Yeah. Who do you think you are? Demi Moore? Say that to the women who reach out to you for help.
That'll be the first thing I say to them. And if you know, and I'll work with them based on how they respond.
I think that's a really good gimmick as a health coach.
Maybe I should just rebuild my webpage and that's on the first page.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't be like Demi. Yeah. Which, depending on how you spell it, it could be really clever. What do you think, looking back on it now, are there major regrets or do you feel like you're a better person because of it? You know what I mean? Would have you done things differently? Or are you almost happy that it happened that way?
I didn't think I'd say this, but I'm almost happy it happened that way. Like, what I do regret is hurting Sean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we both hurt each other throughout the entire relationship. It happens in every relationship.
Yeah.
That part. But I don't think I would have had the growth or figured out what I want in relationships so I can be in happy relationships until I went through that. Like, and I brought on a lot of pain on myself, but like, I remember when I left the night I told him that I wasn't happy and I left, I pulled over 3 blocks from my house and started crying. And it wasn't because I was sad. It was because I hadn't felt that level of relief. I felt like my chest broke open. And that was really powerful. And from that point on, after the 6 months, 7 months, I was divorced officially 7 months later. That's when I left. Like, I went through a lot of stuff in that time, but I had never felt so free, and I started living for myself, and I realized, oh yeah, I have hobbies and interests and likes, and that experience, I try to keep at the forefront of my mind because it's so easy to lose yourself in someone or something else. And when we lose ourselves, it's a disservice to life, mm-hmm. You know? So I've always, since then, in my relationships, tried to make sure that, yeah, you can love someone and support them and to help take care of them, but that you should be getting that back. And it should not ever be to the detriment of your own well-being.
Yeah. Period. How do you know, though? You know, do you think you're better at recognizing when that happens?
I am. It helped me also become a better communicator, because when I was with Phil for 6 years, I could sense patterns coming on, because him and I, we went through a phase where I was working nights, he was in school and working all day. We were on opposite schedules. We were living together, but I rarely saw him. He was in his last semester before he graduated college. And I realized I was flirting with somebody at work. And then I found out through the grapevine, he was trying to find out if I was single or not. And somebody told me that, and I was like, this is a red flag, Jen. This is how things start. And I was able to go like talk to him, my boyfriend at the time, and said, this is what happening. I'm flirting with somebody at work. I wasn't realizing I didn't until I found out like he's interested in me. I'm invested in our relationship. I think this is happening because I feel disconnected from you, and I'd like to figure out how we can reconnect because I don't want to lose this relationship. And I was so like, you know, I felt bad for being like, yeah, I flirted with something, but he was just like, okay, you're right. Let's figure this out. And we did. And we were together for 4 more years, you know, and then we grew apart because of him. But I learned how to recognize when I wasn't getting what I needed in a relationship and then say something before I made stupid mistakes. And I've been able to do that in all my relationships since. Like, I feel things are off, I say something right away. I don't mm-hmm. just bury it. And I work really hard to make sure I'm communicating effectively. So that's been huge. I also try to like make sure that I'm doing stuff for myself and not doing everything with my partner. I've actually just like recently been trying to reassess that with Zach, like, and it's, we're opposite schedules. So like when I do have free time off with him and he's off, all of that time is with him, and which is fine, 'cause that happens a couple days a week. But I also, I want to make sure that we're going to be living together soon, and I'll probably see him a little bit more because of that. I mean, we're essentially living together now, and I've seen him a lot more, which has been great. But I want to be able to like not feel obligated to, like, to stay in my house until he leaves for work. Like, I should just go out and do like this. Like,
yeah,
he was still asleep when I left this morning, and I felt like really good about that. Like, I told him, I was like, hey, I'm leaving in the morning, I'll see you when I see you next, and have a great day. But it was like, that is my way of like reminding myself, like, yeah, I don't, he's not going to stop me. He's not, he thought it was cool that I was coming to do this with you today. Like, I have all the support in the world.
Awesome.
So, but I do have to constantly check myself and like, you know, am I revolving my life around this one person, or am I balancing it between taking care of myself and doing my own stuff? So,
so you've been in relationships pretty much your whole adult life, would you say?
Yes.
If I'm adding this all up correctly in my head?
Between my 6-year relationship and then the relationship I had right before I moved here, I had a year and a half where I was not in a relationship, which is the longest time I've been single in my adult life.
It's very interesting because I kind of do wonder sometimes how this affects us, you know. I have a friend, a male friend, very much the same way. It's actually been on this podcast. You know, he's been in a relationship his entire adult life, you know, pretty much from 18 till 36, with very tiny windows of being single. And it's weird having grown up with him, like since we were kids, you know, And me, like the longest relationship I've had is 13 months, like ever in my life. I've never lived with a woman. Never had like a relationship, like never been married, none of these things. So for me, never been divorced. Like I've never really wanted to be married, but I always want to be divorced. So I don't get to have these experiences. Well, maybe I will, but... But I never have. And so, like, when I ask people about this stuff, like, I'm genuinely kind of curious because it's a world very foreign to me. I've been single pretty much my entire adult
life. Well, and, like, almost the whole time I've known you, you've been single the whole time. You've dated, but you haven't been
in a relationship. Like, superficially.
Yeah.
Like, here and there, you know? And so, like, and I wonder, like, psychologically what this does sometimes, you know? Like, for me, I wonder, like, sometimes I wonder if I'm even capable of having a normal relationship because I'm so used to not having one. So I don't, maybe, but you know, you wonder these things.
It's a big change.
Right. I mean, just like being single after being with someone for so long.
I hated
huge changes.
I hated being single.
Really?
Like by the first, when Phil and I broke up, like it was very sudden and I had, and we had been living together for years. So I had a, like, I mean, I moved out immediately. I had, I took on all the finances myself. I'd been sharing them for 4 or 5 years at that point, 4 years, I think. And so it was like a huge change. And then the hardest thing was sleeping by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm fine sleeping alone. Like with the nights that, well, we haven't had any while, but the nights I don't sleep with Zach, I'm totally fine. I don't give a shit. Like I miss him. Like I like sleeping with him, but I remember how hard it was. Like the first 6-8 months, I hated it. I hated every second of being single. I felt lonely. I hated sleeping alone. Like I got a smaller bed because it was just so caused me anxiety and sadness. And then I got used to it. And I remember the first time someone like stayed over, I was like, God, this person's taking up so much. Like, and it was, it, I felt, it made me laugh because I was like, it's like I took back that, took that back, took myself back because now it's not a big deal. Even though I'm in a relationship, like, so like when we have,
you know, you can survive if it's
not a big deal. And when I'm by myself, it's like, I know I'll see him later. Like I enjoy, I'm comfortable being on my own. And that year and a half, like it's not relatively in my life. It's not very long, but it was so important for me to be in a better place to be like, oh, I am okay as a single gen. Like, I don't have to
be. A single gen.
A single gen is an okay gen.
Yeah.
So that was huge.
I'm sure. Yeah. I think I would have the same anxieties if I had to share this with somebody. What the hell am I doing here? What are they doing in my bed?
Yeah, because you know when you're in a new relationship, I remember the first couple times Zach stayed over, I don't think either one of us slept. Like, you sort of sleep, but you're like, there's a person here.
Yeah.
You know, what if I fart? Like, there's all these things going through your mind. It's not restful at all.
No.
So...
I know.
And then you move past all that. But yeah, it's definitely it's a big transition.
Like, did you ever want kids?
Weirdly enough, I did when I first got married.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I finished my grad program to be a teacher, and I was like, I'm going to teach for a year, and then we're going to get pregnant, and then, you know, whatever. And something changed, and I think it was because I realized, and I don't think I had this conscious thought, was that my husband was not a person I should raise kids with. And I remember talking to him about it, and then it really became, I think that's when my ovaries just shut down. That, and I think being a high school teacher will kill your reproductive system like nothing else. It's the best form of birth control. I remember him saying he wanted to go on these writing retreats by himself to in another state for 6 months at a time. And I was like, if we have a kid, like, you don't get that flexibility.
Writing retreat.
He just wanted to go to a cabin in Alaska. He always would talk, I'm going to go to a cabin in Alaska. I'm going to go to a cabin in Washington and for 6 months and shut out all of society and just write. And I was like, okay, Hemingway, like, cool story, bro. But if you're single, you can do whatever you want. But you have a wife right now. And we're talking about having kids. Like, I'm not raising a kid by myself. I didn't sign up to be a single mom.
I wonder if anyone ever thought of telling Hemingway that. Cool story, bro. You've got responsibilities.
Maybe someone did, and that's why he killed himself.
Maybe so. In some ways, like, I guess you... Is that admirable in a way? I don't know. Like, they've not given a shit and just writing. You know what I mean? Like, obviously... took a huge toll on his marriage, his kids, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, kids that never...
Well, Hemingway in his case.
Oh, Hemingway. Yeah. I didn't realize he had kids.
Yeah, he did.
And he was married. Wow, that must have sucked.
I think he was married multiple times. I think he was married when he killed himself. Yeah, but I'm sure, like, he sacrificed a lot of that. Or, I guess, rather, those women sacrificed a lot, you know? And I think there's something about that. Like, that's the romanticism of it, isn't it? And I'm sure that your husband was very much, like, taken in by that stuff. I mean, I know I was, you know?
Well, and
I think, sometimes.
I thought it was cool to be married to an artist.
Yeah.
Like, that was romantic for a while. Like, oh, he's a writer, and I just want him to spend his days writing, doing what he loves, and all working for Kroger and sell cosmetics and work for VoiceStream Wireless and 60 hours a week. It's all worth it because he was going
to
be a writer.
Explain to me the psychology behind that a little bit from the woman's point of view. I get it from the man's.
I think I just thought it was a romantic idea.
But and you're not alone and you're not the only one and you're not the first and you won't be the last.
No.
What do you think it is about, you know, being married to an artist that's so appealing?
I'm wondering if it's because it goes against the grain of what society tells us to do. Like, being an artist is pretty revered because so few people are talented enough to survive being an artist. And I think the plight of a starving artist is also a romantic idea, like, in itself, is that you're really committed to this goal of being whatever your art is, you know, and there's stories out there. I mean, how many of the successful artists we know, like, they killed themselves before they even felt the fame? They were famous after the fact.
Many.
Like, so many. And so I think just, like, that storyline is so provocative that even if you're not the one being the artist, the idea of
you get to
being,
be around it.
Of being around it is really cool, I think. And I was 23. I was 24 when I got married. Yeah, I was right out of college.
So being young was part
I was
of it.
Young. Yeah. I was in with, like, I met him through mutual friends working at the TV station, and we're doing our own, like, indie films and shorts and projects and entering film festivals. So I was a part of it. And so I thought, oh, this is amazing. Even though I just acted in it. I wrote short pieces, but I wasn't great at it. And I just liked the idea. I loved being around it. So I think that was part of it.
Was this the 90s?
Yeah,
every time you tell these stories, I just picture the 90s.
So I graduated in 96, and I was in college from 96 to 2001.
What a time to have been alive.
Yeah, working with VHS. Yeah, as I said earlier, SVHS.
It's just it's so weird because, like, some of our students now, they'll tell me stuff like, you don't know how lucky you are, man. You grew up in the 90s. And I was like, well, what the fuck are you talking about? It didn't feel like it at the time.
I didn't have a cell phone.
Yeah.
Try living without.
You lived in the greatest era known to man. I mean, the 90s?
You can still wear flannels and Doc Martens.
Yeah,
man.
It's like, all right, man. You know, you can still catch reruns of Married with Children. Yeah. It wasn't that cool. Like, it was okay.
But then, like, I wish I grew up in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
That was the time to be alive.
I think so. Everybody feels a little bit out of place with their, almost everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can look at the previous years. No one's looking at 2020 is going to be the time. We're always looking back like, oh, this is the time. This is the
time. I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, a lot of people ask, like, what is this podcast about? And the truth is, like, I don't know. I don't know what it's about. And I don't. Yeah, me too. I don't necessarily have like an agenda or a theme because my interests are so varied. Yeah. My interest is kind of total. I'm interested in people. I want to talk to people and kind of get to know them a little bit and get to hear their stories. But one thing that. That does come up a lot on the podcast and just comes up a lot in personal conversations is nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about that a lot. Like almost every guest I've had on here, we also stop off at this diner next door, Gunther Tootie's, which is just a nostalgia cave.
Oh, yeah.
It's a time capsule, but it's not, is it?
Yeah.
Because like, you know, it looks like a 1950s diner, right? But it's got all this crazy crap on the wall that obviously wouldn't have been around in the 50s. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like 50s diners, I don't picture having posters of all the movies from the 50s on the diner walls.
No.
You know what I mean? And all the bands from the 50s on all the diner walls. Like other than that, so it's not quite an exact replica of mm-hmm. the past. So I think about this a lot and just like why we're always looking to the past and what kind of effect this is having on us in the present. You know, do you think about this stuff a lot?
I constantly think about the past because I think it informs the future.
Sure.
A lot of times. I think I look for patterns in my life, mm-hmm. and I think that's been helpful. It's like, oh, I've been here before. What did I do last time? How did I process it last time? Or I compare where I'm at now to where I was 2 years ago, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. I also think there's importance in looking forward. Something actually on that note is... my blog post that just came out this week, I talk about New Year's, like, I think New Year's resolutions are stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're false. I think people say, it's New Year, I'm going to do all these amazing things, and they fall short of them. The first thing I say in my blog is, and I said this because I did this once, is, like, gyms capitalize on the New Year because they have all these membership specials
because
they know everybody wants to get in shape for the New Year.
Right.
They're all going to sign up for a membership, and then they're going to go to the gym three times, and the gyms pay their membership but never go. And I think that's shitty that they capitalize on that.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I talk about other ways to, like, I think it's great that when you enter a new year that you set intentions and ideas or visions or goals, but I don't think they need to have these really, I'm going to do this year, period. Like, I think there needs to be more to it. One thing my friend Jackie that we were talking about earlier taught me that this will be the fourth year I've done it, was you write a year in review from a year from now. So I've been working on mine for a couple days because it's kind of hard, but I'm writing a letter to myself from December 31st, 2020 of what I have accomplished this year.
Okay.
And the idea is you're thinking through what you want to get out of the year.
So you're writing as your future self looking backwards.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So you just like thinking about what I want to get out of my life in this year. And mm-hmm. I won't look at it until after December 31st, 2020.
But you're the one who's writing it.
Yeah.
So you know what's in it.
I know it's in it, but this is funny. So I was reading mine Wednesday morning. I opened up my journal and I folded up the page and I have not looked at last year. So I read my letter from December 31st, 2019, looking back, and I read it and I started crying halfway through it because I forgot what I put in there.
Wow.
But some of the intentions I set did happen, even though like once I write that letter, I don't look at it again.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's there, pieces of it are there. Cause I talked about, you know, my financial situation and my job. And the biggest part that I had written in there is that, cause I wrote this and you remember like where I was at a year ago,
yeah.
I came back from Rhode Island. I was trying to date,
I
was associating myself with a very toxic person.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get away from that and not give up all faith in dating. And so I just wrote like, that I had found a good partner, somebody who respects me, you know, that someone who loves me, that we're equals, we respect each other. I still have my own life, but we have our life together. I just like captured what I really wanted in a relationship. And when I was reading it Wednesday, I cried because it is exactly what I have right now.
Wow.
And so I didn't, you know, that was just, maybe I pulled some of my past to write that, but I was looking to the future for those intentions to kind of, and not everything I wrote. And I think I wrote like, I'm going to be a full-time health coach. Like, I'm not there yet. I also haven't put the work in.
Right.
I've let other things derail me. I've made other choices. Like, I'm making steps, but I can't pay my rent. I don't even have a client yet.
I wonder what that, you know, I'm doing a podcast. It seems like everyone's doing a podcast. You want to be a health coach. To be honest, it seems like everyone is a health coach. Do these things daunt you at all? Sometimes they do me.
Yeah. So I also want to do a podcast, and everybody has a podcast. Zach and I are talking about doing one.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've probably experienced this. How many times have you asked me if I've seen a movie and I've stared at you blankly?
Mostly.
Yeah. So it's going to be based on that.
It's going to be based on that. He's going to ask you the title of a movie. You're going to stare at him. So then, and the audience fills in the blanks.
Right. So he's going to, we're going to talk about what I think it might be, mm-hmm. what I think the movie is about. Then pause, watch the movie, and then talk about my reaction to it.
Okay.
It's sort of weak concept, but
what movies would make this list? Like, what movies
pretty
come
much
up a
everything
lot?
That wasn't produced by John Hughes.
Those are the only movies you've seen. It's seen John others. Hughes films.
Hey, I watched an indie film on the plane home.
What movie?
Blinded by the Light.
Blinded by the
it's
Light.
It's about a kid, Pakistani kid,
uh-huh.
living in England in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Late 70s, early 80s, who becomes infatuated with Bruce Springsteen.
I remember the previous.
Yeah, it's pretty cute.
It seemed cute.
Yeah, it was a great plane movie.
I could see that. It seemed to me like one of those movies that kind of writes itself. Like,
yeah.
As soon as I saw the trailers, like, I've seen this. I know exactly what I'm supposed to feel when I go see it. It's funny because I was talking to Mike about this today. We were talking about A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, I still haven't seen that.
You still haven't seen that
of
one?
Of course not.
Well, I was telling him that I was talking to a Ukrainian friend of mine. Who had seen the movie, probably dubbed into Russian, and she was asking me, like, what is this movie about? And I had to really, like, and I feel like I can explain it easier to somebody like Mike or you or somebody who gets the subtleties of American English, you know? But with her, I was having a really hard time trying to articulate it, like, at its core and at its simplest. What trying to defend the movie because it's a movie I love a lot. Mm-hmm. And I could tell she was pretty disgusted by it. And I'm trying to do justice to a movie and also explain what it's really about in the simplest English possible because her English isn't so great.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a hard time doing this. And the one thing that Mike kind of reminded me of was an article about Kubrick in which the gentleman writing it said something to the effect of, you know, the thing about Kubrick's films is that he never expected us to feel anything, something like that. Mm-hmm. That's not demanded of the audience. Like, we're not supposed to feel something about these characters.
Hmm.
Or maybe not supposed to is the word, but he's not trying to impose a feeling on people. You know, the feelings that you get from the movies are a lot more ambiguous. And so I felt like a movie that you just mentioned, Blinded by the Light, you know, many movies that come out now, I feel like the feeling is already imposed on us. And therefore, like, when I see these trailers, I feel like I know what I'm supposed to feel. I know what's expected of me as an audience member. I don't want to give it to them, so I'm not going to watch it, you know. So I don't, but then again, at the same time, like, if everybody made really, like, ambiguous movies like Kubrick, it wouldn't be so great either, would it?
Yeah.
You know?
I think people want to feel sometimes. They want to feel something other than what they're currently feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a way to escape.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
They do, and it's valuable. Like, you know, movies as entertainment, absolutely. Like, we need that stuff. We definitely need that stuff. We need superficial things sometimes. But just maybe not as much of it as we get. I feel like it's got to be a diet. Like, you've got to not, you know, you can't eat nothing but candy all the time.
Right.
Balance. You know? Yeah, for sure. Like, I feel like it's not good for your mental nutrition to just, like, watch garbage.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true. That's mm-hmm. true. Did I answer your question about?
Kind of. Like, well, we're talking about nostalgia, like the 90s, you know? The 90s are pretty big to you.
Yeah,
mostly music. You mentioned music a lot.
Music is my thing.
But the movies didn't really enter into.
It's funny. I used to watch movies constantly. Mm-hmm. Like, in high school, I watched a lot of movies. And then in my marriage, I did because my husband was really interested in movies and wanting to write films or produce. And I got so tired of always having to watch these deep, metaphorical films
mm-hmm.
that I think that's why I don't watch many movies now.
Ah.
I think I just like, I think I had this resistance. Like, someone's like, oh, you guys see this movie? I'm like, nope, sure
yeah.
don't.
Yeah.
Sure don't.
No, and, I don't got to do anything.
And I don't, it's like, I also, I feel like my attention span, I don't always have it for a movie. I don't want to pay attention that
interesting.
Long. And that bothers
What's that
me.
All about?
Yeah, that's I feel like part of that is I've always multitasked.
Mm-hmm.
Put that in air quotes because none of us do it well. But, like, I have to be busy a lot. Mm-hmm. That's something I've been working on. So I just feel like when something goes on, like I can watch a whole episode of Saturday Night Live. That's sometimes more than an hour. Like that's not that long, but sometimes I end up playing a game on my phone while I'm watching.
Isn't
it.
Isn't that weird? It like is. It's something that you never would have done when you were in your 20s.
No.
You know, well, even when you're, well, that's the thing, right? Like you didn't need something to distract you. You weren't thinking like, Jesus, I wish I had something to play with right now. I'm watching this.
Yeah. And so it's like, that's not, I haven't always done that. So that's, I mean, yeah, I'd watch TV shows and movies. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a cell phone in high school. Like I just do be engaged in that activity. So I don't know if part of it is like, if my brain feels like it's not constantly doing more than one thing, it's, it wigs out. I don't know. There's like a short circuit.
I think so.
Like I think technology is to blame. Just like,
I agree. I think that we pick up on a lot of these things, whether subtly or not so subtly, we feel like we need to be doing this stuff, you know, because we see everybody else doing it.
Mm-hmm.
We have it. It's in our pockets, you know. Mm-hmm. And so just by proximity, you're like, well, it's here. I should check. My leg is vibrating. I better check on this, you know.
Yeah.
And that just, it just, I do it too. I'm guilty of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I feel like I'm better than some, worse than others at putting it away when I'm watching a film or something, but god damn, I'm always looking at it when I shouldn't be.
Yeah, I want to break that because I'd like to be able to focus on just one thing and just let my mind relax and just say, yeah, it's okay to just watch this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can do it on sometimes, like I can sit and watch something and just be engaged in that.
What was the last thing besides being captive on a plane that got your attention so much that you were able to watch it without
distraction?
Yeah.
So there's a Netflix special called You. Season 2 just came out.
I've heard of this. No, maybe it's, I haven't. What is it? What is You?
It is... Oh, I'm going to sneeze. It's about...
It's let it out.
Okay. Well, no, it's gone now that I acknowledged it. This guy who is a psychopath, but you wouldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. Him. He's very manipulative, but... becomes obsessed and fixated on a woman and kind of infiltrates into their life where it looks organic, but it's incredibly like strategic. And I don't want to say too much cause I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it. And it's a thriller and it can be a little gory at times. And that's typically stuff I try to stay away from cause I feel like it activates anxiety for me.
Sure.
But, like, we watched a couple episodes this week, and they're, like, 40, you know, 30, anywhere between 30 and 60 minutes long. And I was, like...
30, like, it varies? The length varies?
I guess how Zach put it is when Netflix does specials, it's as long as it is. So some of their episodes of a Netflix series are maybe, like, 30-ish minutes, 35 minutes, and sometimes they're, like, 60.
I kind of like that. I think that makes sense.
Yeah, they don't feel like they have, the story has to be exactly 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate that because they always feel like they end in an appropriate, it's been an appropriate amount of time for things to unfold with enough that there's, you know, you're not dragging it out.
Yeah.
You're not cutting it short.
Yeah.
So I think that's cool. I didn't realize that, but I was like super engaged in it because there's so much going on and I was afraid to look away from the TV. Yeah, but like seriously, I think the longest episode was maybe it was like 50 minutes long. I think the season opener was like an hour, but
I think I have seen clips, like pieces of it. I think my
you
sister's watching.
You might actually like it.
It's, everyone says that.
I
like
know.
You say, when people say you're supposed to watch this, you say no. When people say you might actually like it, I know I won't.
It's like this, like automatic. No.
Yeah.
But then I'm trying to think of like the last movie I sat down and watched.
Mm-hmm.
I watched, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. I watched that.
Uninterrupted.
Yep. Okay. Actually, I might have stopped to go to the bathroom or make dinner.
Okay. It's a little different than the phone, but it's still.
Yeah.
It's still one of those things where, like, we just can't sit there. Like, and I guess that's the wonderful thing about movie theaters, you know, it's just being captive.
Mm-hmm. I guess, that's the only other time I've been captive. Is like every once in a while we'll go to the Alamo for a date night and watch a movie, and you can't have phones out there, which I love.
Yeah.
What was
the last movie you saw there?
We saw Hollywood. It was Quentin Tarantino's.
Notes. Yeah. Okay.
Which was good. It was so long.
Long?
It was so long.
Yeah.
And I should know this because Quentin Tarantino.
He likes to take his time.
He does like to take his time.
He likes to meander.
He did meander. It was good. I
enjoyed
it.
Once upon a time
in Hollywood. There we go. But I was right there. Like you're forced to be, but it was also like, yeah, one. So, and I think Toy Story 4. Mm-hmm. Saw that one.
I heard this was really good.
I can't think of the other one.
I still think it's a great place to be. And I hope that we see more of those and not less. Movie theaters.
Yeah, I do too. Because it really is nice to kind of have some parameters to go into. Like,
it is.
You're coming in to do this. You can have a beer. You can mm-hmm. have some nachos. Yeah. Keep your phone away.
It starts at this time, mm-hmm. not a second before or later. Mm-hmm. If you come in late, sorry. You know, you just got to... Mm-hmm. You know, bear it.
You talk, they'll kick you out.
Exactly. Yeah, I like that.
It's pretty strict, but I do. Yeah. I love it because I know we're all in there to watch a movie. It's going to be quiet. Yeah. I'm not going to be distracted by other people. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite movie theater experience? You know, one that kind of transcended just merely sitting there and watching a movie?
I think the Alamo. Like, that's the first. Like, in Oregon, we had Cinetopia and Vinatopia, and they were that whole you can go in and have a beer with your mm-hmm. movie. But, like, the Alamo, it's like you get to pick, you reserve your seats online. So mm-hmm. you know where you're sitting. You can, Zach has specific seats he likes to get every time. They're comfortable.
Yeah.
It's a really, the whole experience is nice.
It is. But I guess I was wondering if there's, like, one specific one that you saw that was just, like, a transcendent experience for you. Where all of it came together, the movie, the company you were with, the audience, the time you saw it, the time it came out, the context of the era in which you saw it in.
In my entire life?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
If anything jumps to mind.
I saw Little Women, like, in the 90s.
Yeah?
And that
was... Winona Ryder vehicle, I think?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that one. I'm really sad that they're redoing it again, because that's what we do.
It got really good reviews, though.
Did it?
Yeah. You know,
and that was my favorite book growing up, Little Women. Yeah. I had this worn... I don't have it anymore, which kind of makes me sad, but I read that book 1,000 times. Like, I wanted to be Joe in the
book. Who wrote the book again? Was it one of the Brontes?
Louisa May Alcott.
Louisa May Alcott. I'm embarrassed I don't know that, but I've never read it, and I gotta be honest, like, with all the reviews of the new ones, I do want to see it. I kind of want to read the book as well.
I would read the book. Yeah, because
I've never seen any of them, so I really want to.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I honestly don't even know what it's about, other than the obvious.
Yeah, like, that's really what it's about. I've seen the previews for the new one, and it looks pretty good.
The woman who directed it, I like her.
Yeah. I always get, like, I think I just get little ruffles in my feather. I'm like, why are we doing this movie that was my child? Like, you know.
I know what you mean. Yeah, me thing, too. Yeah, there you go. There's the nostalgia word again. The N-word. The real N-word.
The real N-word.
That might belittle other people who are upset about the other. Yeah. I didn't mean it that way. But it bothers me too. And yet at the same time, I kind of realize that, like, most stories are recycled, you know what I mean? And, like, the thing about, like, well, everything is a remake now. Well, you know, in the 50s, they were remaking movies that came out in the 30s, you know what I mean? In the 30s, they were telling stories that were written as plays in the 1800s, and those were based on novels that were, you know what I mean? So it's like, they're all reimagining things for the most part. So I try not to get too uptight about it. And some stories are so universal that maybe they need to be updated once in a while. You know what
That's
I mean?
True.
Even if they're viewed through a filter of a certain historical time period, like Little Women, you know, like maybe it doesn't take place today, but it's made and the actresses portraying it are going to be younger people. So it's still going to be through a younger lens than those girls who made it in the 90s.
Yeah.
So maybe it just gives it a certain, like, I mean, because everybody said, like, this A Star Is Born was so fantastic, right? The newest, the one with Lady Gaga and what's his name? Brad something.
Yes.
Bradley Cooper.
Bradley Cooper, yes.
And it's like the fourth version of that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, it's interesting because, again, it got great reviews. Sean Penn said it was one of the best movies he's ever seen or something like that.
Wow.
He did a lot of press for it. My buddy saw it, and he said it was great, but he also said, I'd never seen any of the others. So he had, like, nothing to compare it to. And I've never seen any of the others. Mm-hmm. So I haven't seen this one yet, but... So I guess, like, it kind of does have some legitimacy, doesn't it, when you're...
Yeah.
It made me rethink it. I used to be so automatically prejudiced against remakes, and now I'm kind of relaxing a little bit about it.
Yeah. Well, and I guess if you look at it from the artist's perspective, like, who are we to say that an artist feels called to remake a movie through their lens that they shouldn't?
Yeah, I don't think it's always just a cynical way to make money. I mean, I think oftentimes it is. I think that's what people more roll their eyes at, is like when it's so transparently a cynical way to make money. And something about Little Women tells me that's not the case. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
But something like Godzilla, you know, ad nauseum. That's exactly what they're doing, you know. Or the Joker. The Joker is the one that came out recently. I haven't seen it.
I haven't either.
But I feel like I know exactly what it's about.
Yeah.
Again, one of those movies I feel like I know exactly what I'm supposed to feel at the end. But it's also a movie where I don't even think it's a bad idea or a bad concept. I think that it's, I could tell that it tackles some modern mental health issues. And I could tell that it tackles a lot of issues dealing especially with like alienated males in society. I feel though like it doesn't need the Joker. It doesn't need a comic book character, a tried and tested and true money making character in order to sell it. I feel like all those ideas could have and should have probably been put into a movie that doesn't cynically use the Joker to sell tickets. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like they're dealing with, but then again, maybe that's the only way to get people to buy into seeing a movie that has high concept ideas like that. Maybe they think if they made stuff like that without a money-making name attached to it, no one would see it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. I didn't think about that.
I think about this too much. I sit alone in this doctor's office. This is what I think about.
That's what you think about.
Yeah. I don't know. There's probably weightier things. War with Iran. I guess I should be thinking about that.
Yeah. I am so ignorant. I don't know what's happening.
No.
Because I'm afraid.
It's not good. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. I picked up on that much.
Well, I don't know. How do you feel? You feel like we tackled some good stuff?
I do.
Me too. I appreciate you coming by.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
For having me. It's not a problem, man, he knows we're